Welcome to the Delling Pod with me, James Dellingpole. And I now always say I'm excited about this week's special guest. But before we meet him, let's have a word from one of our sponsors. You might have noticed that the gold and silver prices have been on a tear recently. Silver prices especially. Silver's gone up like a rocket, and gold has been doing pretty well too. If you bought silver when I first started talking about it a few years ago, you would have quadrupled your investment by now. If you bought gold, you'd certainly have doubled it. And you're probably wondering, is it too late? Can I still get into this market and make money? Well, there are lots of reasons why you should have gold, physical gold and silver as an insurance against the continued decline of fiat currency, the uncertainties in the conventional stock markets. I'm not a financial advisor, I would definitely have some physical gold and silver. And where do you buy this? Well, I would go to the Pure Gold Company. You can buy your gold and silver in the form of coins, for example, gold sovereigns or Britannias or silver Britannias, or you can buy bars, and you can either have it delivered to your home or you can have it stored for you in vaults in London or Switzerland or wherever you feel is best suits your need. The Pure Gold Company offers a buyback guarantee, fair prices without delay. So if you have changed your mind at any moment, you can trade in your gold or silver. You call their brokers to discuss your various options. They can advise you on tax issues. Will silver go up again? Yes, probably. Will it go down again? Yes, probably. But I would say you should have some silver and gold in some form, as long as it's solid silver and solid gold, not paper gold. And I would go to the Pure Gold Company, thepuregoldcompany.co.uk/James-Dellingpole/. Welcome back to the Delling Pod, Francis O'Neill. Thank you for doing this. My life's been in complete chaos since my dad died. Are your parents still alive?
Yeah, they're both still alive, actually.
Well, make the most of them while they are, because when they go, it's quite sudden. You can't suddenly say any more things to them or ask them any more questions that you always meant to ask, because they're not there. They just don't come back.
Well, I've been thinking about this a little bit recently because I've just got back from the bank holiday weekend. We celebrated my parents' 50th wedding anniversary.
Nice.
So, yeah, you don't get. I don't know how much of an innings you get after that, but yeah, they're quite fit and healthy and stuff. But you start to become aware of the passing of time and so on, and you don't have forever.
You don't. I mean, of course, these are all cliches, but nevertheless, they're cliches, yeah. Because they're well-worn truths. And it's weird. I keep sort of, wanting to get on the phone to ring up my dad to tell him all the exciting things that have been happening, like, and Pa's dead. You hear this, but of course, he's the one that's dead, and you can't fill him in all the new, because he'd have loved it. He'd have loved all the kind of the excitement and the commotion it's caused in the family and stuff. And it's all good. I mean, these things happen. I think I'm going to become a slightly different person.
Yeah, I can empathize to a degree, because it's one of my grandmas, we call her my nana, and my auntie, who we stayed with them for about a year when we were kids, and so we were quite close to them both, and they've both, you're kind of surprised sometimes, aren't you, how it affects you, because you don't have that presence anymore, and the way they saw you and the way they interact with you, you kind of lose something of a relationship that you don't have with anyone else. It moves on, doesn't it, and that's gone for good.
Well, it does. There's a thing where you sort of move up the kind of the death pecking order, so that I'm no longer my dad's kid anymore. And I think you stay the kid while they're still alive. And now I'm not his little boy anymore. I'm sort of the grown up.
Yeah.
I'm glad I got you. So thank you for doing this, because there are some people that I feel very comfortable doing general chit chat freestyling with. I mean, Tanya was another one, and Dick, obviously, and Bob would be another. It's what I've realized is that there are very, very few. This has become quite a shock to me because I'm a very trusting sort. I mean, naively trusting, actually. I always give people the benefit of the doubt. But I think we've sort of touched on this before. I've become really aware recently of, painfully aware of just how horribly infiltrated our movement, if it is a movement, you know, the general state of awakeness, how heavily infiltrated we are.
Yeah, well, I come on these shows like your show or Speak to You Now, say, I've said before, and I get afterwards, I come away thinking, so I'll say something like, I talked about the line, it's below Boris Johnson, and it's like, it might be below Lawrence Fox, and then the line might be below Andrew Bridgen, and you go through all these people, the Andrew Tates and Russell Brand. And I've always been trying to make clear to people that, no, it's actually, it's on the online sphere, it's maybe even in people you interact with in person. And so I say this as though I know what I'm talking about, right, over the past 4 or 5 years. And to a degree, I do know, because I've seen the infiltration of the 9/11 movement. And so there isn't, but even I am getting kind of surprised or almost embarrassed that they must have been laughing at me when I was saying these things on podcasts. Some of the people who you later realize were infiltrators that you were interacting with as though they were not. And I'm going on talking on shows about, oh yeah, I think this and that, I think that. And they're thinking, well, he hasn't cottoned on to us yet. But in a way, you don't want to be, the natural way to be is to be trusting. You shouldn't have to. I mean, should is kind of a crazy word as well, because you have expectations that don't match reality, but you shouldn't have to distrust everybody. You shouldn't have to be cynical and wary and looking over your shoulder. And yet we have just lived through 5 or 6 years where the government's been trying to kill us. And the way that they did that was to marshal every available talking head they could to convince us that injecting poison into our arms was a good thing to do. And they did this not just with the big figures I talked about, like your politicians and prime ministers and your media talking heads, like your mainstream media. They did this with ordinary people. They did this with the people that you would suspect the least. They did it with people on Instagram. And you know, like we're talking about now, maybe there's a few of them around. Like, I just, off the top of my head, one that is like Leilani Downing is like a Page Three girl. So they're using Page Three girls. They try to, they use the mayor trying to get you to take a burger for thinking a burger, free burger would get you. So all these people that you might not suspect, and might, they were there. There's even one guy, there's this black Instagram bodybuilding fitness guru type of guy. And he talks about all the diet and how you should eat this and that. And he was pictured getting his COVID shot. And he posts the video, yeah, and celebrates it. So you're not expecting it from this fitness guru to tell you how to, that he's getting the COVID. You'd think he'd be pure natural health, and actually a lot of people who keep fit were concerned about what was going into the body, and they were, like, the gyms were closed, so you'd see them on the pull-up bars in the park, and there'd be a gaggle of people, and they were obviously using the bars, and they weren't scared of touching the same surfaces and stuff. So you think that the fitness community might be awake and things like this. But what I'm trying to say is that it's the people that you don't, the deception works, like it works, it's a bit of a tautology, but it works by deceit. So if you can recognize it, then it's not going to work.
Yeah. There's an example of this. I'm not going to mention his name, but he's quite sort of prominent in awake podcasting circles. And he's one of those ex-medics that saw the light and has become very anti-vax and anti, you know, exposing all the stuff. And about the time of the sort of, oh, the meningitis scare, suddenly meningitis, you really needed, all your teenagers were going to die of meningitis unless they got the jab. And he produced this very lengthy article on his Substack, which was talking about vaccination as being an important part of the prophylactic measures that you might take to deal with meningitis. And I was thinking, well, I think quite a few of us read this and thought, it was a long screed, so it was quite an ordeal getting through it. But a lot of us thought, well, you're supposed to know that vaccination is bad across the board. So what are you doing telling your kind of biddable, your more biddable, credulous followers that vaccination did nothing go in your head? Like, hang on a second, what am I doing? I mean, it was obvious that he got AI to write the piece, but even so, you can decide the parameters when you get AI to write your articles. And I thought, yeah, et tu.
Yeah, well, one of the things you have to have identifiers for people. So if I think I know who you're talking about, and they talk about, they have publicly acknowledged that all vaccines are bad, and they'll push that in their interviews and whatnot. They'll say that all vaccines are bad. So then if they put out an essay like that, then you think, well, what are you doing there? So first of all, I know when I write anything and I'm trying to be factual, I'm very careful with the footnotes or the hyperlinks and making sure that you can defend your case if it comes to it. You get a chance to proofread and edit and go through it. So you can't just put out just something off the top of your head. It's a little bit more difficult when you're speaking, because sometimes, you know, you're calling upon words, or you might misspeak, or you arrange a sentence in a way that maybe mislead somebody incidentally, but they get the gist of what you're saying. But you're not trying to.
And you're a painter, Francis. So words are not necessarily your.
Yeah,
you paint word pictures.
I can barely speak, right? So can barely formulate a sentence.
And you're Irish, so you probably didn't. You're probably living in a bog. Two generations ago. Yeah.
I'd probably be better off in the bog. I've been thinking this recently. You know, if I'd have started at 16 or 17 with like a plot of land in a bog and just started building just a wigwam or a tent, and then just try to nurture put all my life's work into gardening and building a home, by 34 years later you'd have a home and a garden instead of being faffing around trying to get their slave token currency.
It is, after all, what God obviously intended us to do. He did not want us to become sustainability consultants. He didn't want us to go into the city and engage in usury, because after all, that is one of the things he's always enjoining us not to engage in throughout the Old Testament. He didn't want us to become to engage in pharmacopoeia, or however you pronounce it, you know, the sorcery of so-called modern medicine. So all these jobs that everyone's got, that they've accepted in order to become part of the beast system, they are absolutely not what we were meant to do. We're meant to be having, I mean, I don't know how our lovely holidays to Greece and stuff fits into this plan, but because I'm quite glad the aeroplane was invented, even if they do now use it to spread chemtrails and spray us with poison and stuff. But you know what I mean? But generally, I think we are meant to be able to put up a barn, Amish style. We are meant to be able to grow organic vegetables and rear livestock and know how to slaughter livestock. And everything else is just kind of poison icing on the cake with nasty sprinkled hundreds and thousands, probably laced with barium and aluminium and arsenic on top.
I think that's a part of the reason why they can compromise people like who we are talking about, is because people have those difficulties, because they're not able to. If you were able to sustain yourself, then it's very difficult to be compromised. What do you need from anyone? If you've got a wife and kids and a home and even things like slaughtering animals, there's an argument to say that you then have a certain reverence for the food you eat, because you've had to, you understand the difficulty of killing a large animal or even a small animal like a chicken. You have a certain reverence, and it also maybe you understand the process of sacrifice. You have to take the life, and maybe that also discharges some of your aggression, because you recognize what happens if you use your aggression to its fullest. So maybe that makes for a more peaceful society ultimately. I don't know. I'm just speculating.
No, Francis, you're dead right. Look, I've spent a lot of my time, since moving to the country especially, in the world of country folk who engage in activities like hunting, shooting and fishing. And I can tell you, for example, that nobody loves the fox more than hunting people. It's because obviously the fox is the quarry that provides the sport, but also because you want a healthy fox population, because actually nobody in my experience actually wants to kill the fox. They want the fox to get away. The foxes that get killed are the ones with mange, the old ones, which would die a horrible death anyway. And they're the ones that predate on livestock because they're incapable of getting fast moving prey. So they tend to, that's why those are the ones that get your chickens and just slaughter all your chickens. They're the ones that take lambs. I've seen lambs which have, in particularly harsh winters where, ewes have been giving birth to lambs and the fox has taken the lamb as it's coming out of the, it's a horrible sight. You know, and it is part of that sort of natural balance, which I would call God divinely ordained. That's how it's meant to be. And one of the things my dad brought us up, when I first went away to boarding school, I was very aware that I had certain shortcomings. And one of the shortcomings I had was, I hope you don't mind reminiscing about Mike, because he's one of the shortcomings I noticed I had was that all the other boys, most of them, were really good at kicking footballs around. They had ball skills. I didn't have one of those dads who played football with me. My dad was doing things like, we were going to the pond at the end of our garden and looking for newts and looking at the dragonfly larvae and going on walks and looking at gall wasps on oak leaves and identifying trees and stuff. And then on our holidays, we got really into collecting reptiles and amphibians. We had a lizard house and a snake house in our garden, which my mother never much liked. And we would, when everyone else was on the beach, we would go collecting lizards in buckets and you'd grease the rim with butter. And you put sort of fruit in the bottom and the lizards would crawl in and they wouldn't be able to get out again because of the grease on the bucket. We'd bring them, but you could still carry lizards on airplanes in those days. You couldn't do it now. We used to bring them back in our hand luggage in linen bags and then breed them and all sorts of things. So the point is that I was brought up to appreciate nature and to have an understanding of it. And I remember killing my first chicken. I was in the Sudan in the middle of nowhere. We didn't have much food and certainly no fresh meat. And we went to this remote village in the middle of the Sudan. And the villagers kindly gave us these two very scrawny chickens, which probably wouldn't have fed more than a couple of people if you were doing a Sunday roast at home. And we had to volunteer, you know, who would kill these chickens? And I said, well, I want to do it because I want to be able to understand the process of transforming this thing from a live animal into meat. And I think you need that understanding. A lot of the animal rights campaigners have no understanding or connection with the landscape, with animals or anything else. Whereas I kind of love them. At the same time, I think that if God had meant us not to eat animals, he wouldn't have made them of meat, a tasty meat at that. So, I think that the process of what's been happening in the world, particularly it's accelerated in the last 100 years, is this process where we've been deracinated from our traditions, from the land, our connection with the land, with God creation, and turned us into these automatons of this kind of artificial world where it's all done for us. And this is all deliberate, that they've tried to take us away from living a natural life.
Well, you mentioned football there and those kind of sports. I think now, obviously, I've enjoyed playing them and there are benefits to them. And when I say this, people always say, oh, they point out the plus sides to them. You know, it keeps people fit and it's camaraderie and you learn to be sociable and things like this. But if you think about when they were introduced and the fact that they were most likely and they seem to be introduced as Freemasonic games for the plebs, you know,
so then certainly by the time every city had at least two major football clubs, divide and rule. And you're right, they were controlled by Freemasonry.
But if you think about what young men would have done before they had these kind of organized sports to do, or what their dads would have taught them, or what the old kind of customs would have been. It would have been to not only learn trades, but they have to have some enjoyment and some sport and some ways of letting off steam. It would have been things like hunting and also learning self-defense and how to defend yourself and your property. So like people might learn archery, they might learn swordsmanship and things like this. And so if you bring up a population who can kick the ball into the goal and all those kind of skills of aim and understanding of trajectory and physicality are not given in self-defense, you have, and as well, you take the weapons off them and you forbid them from having weapons, then suddenly you have a population who are engrossed by the sport that you've chosen. In this case, football, could be rugby, whatever. And they don't know how to defend themselves and they can't grow anything and they can't hunt. It's very clever.
Did I mention to you before, this was one of my early tells with David Icke.
Yeah, you said, yeah.
I'll mention it for those who haven't heard it. So I did my live event with David, and this time I was so naive, I thought Icke was, you know, he was kind of a hero of the resistance because he predicted all these things which had come true and stuff. And in the green room beforehand, I mentioned this point about the Freemasonic connections of football and how the football clubs were established in order to divide and rule cities. So you've got Everton versus Liverpool and Man U versus Man City and so on. And he didn't go, yeah, you're so right. This is out there. He didn't want to talk about it. I think he sort of denied that this was the case, or that sort of, it was weird. I mean, that would be, it's the kind of thing you would think an awake person who's been down the rabbit hole for a while would be really onto and really hot on.
Yeah, they would. Do you think they would be just a natural kind of, yeah, I know about that. Yeah, of course it is. Everything's kind of like that.
Yeah, yeah.
It would be just something just casually exactly. Absorbed. I've casually absorbed that over the past 20, 30, 40 years being the lead conspiracy theorist in the whole world. You might think I've come across that one. It's not something that's going to affront you, given the kind of conspiracy theories he espouses. Yeah.
There's one of the things I've been struggling with recently. I don't know whether you've got a view on this. I still use Substack quite a lot, even though it's controlled. And I noticed that a lot of Substack voices are really into this kind of witch hunting thing at the moment, where they're, for example, they're really exercised about the funding model of UK column, and they're really keen to expose what a bunch of evil, compromised traitors UK column are, and how we can never trust them again, and they're so there. And there's another one. He's created these three. I've noticed, by the way, two of the people I've identified as wrongs. They've got very round faces. I don't understand. I don't know why this is. You've got like footballs. Maybe it's a connection. But dividing everyone into camps of correctness and sort of acting as a sort of witch finder general of the awake movement, and which is why I try and strike a balance between being aware of who's potentially a wrong one, but at the same time not making a big deal of it, because then I feel that we're playing the divide and rule game, and it's quite a hard balance to maintain. But have you noticed this going on? There seems to be at the moment the truth movement seems really, really messed up at the moment.
Yeah, I have noticed this, and there's a slight elephant in the room here as well, because Leo and I have noticed this with people close to us, and we've mentioned it in our little show that we do, and it's difficult to know what's going on exactly, because so from my point of view as a viewer, or just someone who's consuming this kind of media, I can know that I can trust myself. I know that I'm not compromised. And I've said this before. So most of your listeners will be in the same situation. They know they're not CIA or Mossad or MI5. And they know that they've not been paid.
Unless they've been MK Ultra'd and they've got various alters. And one personality knows, but the other ones don't.
Well,
don't rule that one out.
Well, as much as we can know anything, the audience know that we're not involved in that. And then, so you can trust yourself. And then you have to think, well, what are these people saying? And are there any anomalies? So I've recently listened to Debbie Evans and Sandy Adams, isn't it? Talk about UK Column. And their concerns seem fair enough to me. And I don't think any alternative media site should be above question. So I know that, for example, I've got relationships with people I'm questioning now, and you've got relationships with people from UK Column, and you might want to question them now, but the information that these two ladies have given doesn't seem to me to be, it seems to me to be reasonable. They've got reasonable questions. So if there are reasonable questions, then we require reasonable answers. So for example, if you've got a funder, then why was he secret initially? And then, so it's come out because of some kind of, public, you have to declare who's funding you for tax returns or something like this. Anyway, there's a reason why this Marcel Janker has been named. And suddenly people have become aware that he's got a 20% stake in UK Column. So you think, okay, well, why didn't you just declare that in the first? Oh, because he's private. Okay, but then you've been doing these things in China. So there are questions there, and I'm not here to answer them. I don't know UK Column. And the two ladies seem reasonable. For example, I want to just my experience. So again, if we're talking about me as someone encountering these people in these institutions, my experience of UK Column, I was struggling for work in the period after lockdown where I'd lost my studio and so on. And people saying, you should contact UK Column. They employ, they've had a bit of turnover of staff recently and you should try. And I was like, well, they're not really my scene. I don't really listen to them that much, but I do need work and I'm doing the yellow boards anyway. So I could be on I could give them reports from London on the ground or whatever, just to see what they say. So I wrote to them. And it was Debbie Evans who replied, and she seemed very nice. And so my experience of her was that she was the only one. And she said, I'm not a director, but I'll. And she said, at the very least, we can get you on for an interview and you can talk about your buzz. So she seemed open to it. And I judge people almost like it's not a particularly foolproof judging method, but the way they interact with me, because most of the people who are not right, they don't want me anywhere near anything. They don't want me speaking. They don't want to be near the microphone. They don't want to be near the front of anything. They don't want to raise my profile. They don't share my articles. They don't like my articles. They don't talk about me. So there are ways of seeing, because I know I'm genuine. So they don't want genuine voices out there. So Debbie Evans is like, okay, well, and she hopefully won't mind me saying this. She wrote back and said, this is interesting, and maybe we get you in for interview. And I said, I wasn't actually looking for interview. I was wondering if you've got any employment. She says, well, I don't make those decisions because it's the directors who are the men, basically, that they'll make the decisions. She said, but I'll put it in front of them. So, and then my friends were saying, have you heard back? And I never heard back. I never got a response from them, even just to say, oh yeah, we'll get you on for an interview, but we've got no work. So I thought that was really interesting, but not just in itself. It's not particularly interesting because they might have been busy, but then, a chap called Montgomery Tom started to join the yellow boards, and then within 2 minutes he's working for UK Column and working for Together, who had also had interactions with, and they kept these two institutions together would keep me as far away from anything public facing as possible. So my experience of them thinks, well, that's curious. Maybe I'm just not very good at public facing business, and they didn't rate me. And Montgomery Tom's got the look and the thing and whatever they wanted. Maybe he's younger, it's a younger audience. But then as obviously watch these people, how their alternative media career goes and the kind of things they get up to and the kind of scrapes they get into and how their profile is amplified, or like in mainstream media's written up, like The Spectator wrote about Montgomery Tom raising his profile, or he's now sort of like a pound shop Charlie Kirk, where he goes and sits outside universities with a desk and tries to debate people. You look you look at the provocative things that they do, but also, My take on it now is James, is that they're almost all controlled. And my take was that like that beforehand, because I had 20 years of after 9/11 where you sort of realize that they're all controlled because they don't speak about the important relevant issues. None of them. So they're controlled either wittingly or unwittingly. And then when it came to 2020, you've seen them all kind of filter out of the mainstream media and drop down to you. And you think, default was that they're fake and controlled. But then I think, well, I've got people in my family waking up. I've got people, friends waking up. So I know they're not part of it. So it's also possible that people in the media have woken up and come around to it. So then you like give a little bit of, slack to people, and you think, okay, I'll operate in good faith with them as though they're operating in good faith. And almost every single time, there's like people now that I don't trust, that you've maybe seen. And one other thing that's a really important point, that I think is you, for your audience as well, like is that sometimes like squabble, what appear to be squabbles will break out online. And maybe the UK column thing is one of them. So you maybe get a squabble break, and people are squabble. It's unseemly. I don't want to look at that. It's just people arguing. It's infighting. Often it's not infighting. It's where we meet the enemy. So you might think if I'm arguing with someone on Twitter, I don't argue with people who are basically on the same. I argue. I continue to speak to people when I'm trying to find out, oh, is this where I meet the enemy? Are you real? Like, and usually when people attack me, that's another one of my gauges, because I can only operate through my experience. Is there's no reason to attack me. I've not got particularly large followings. I'm not particularly well known. You could just ignore me and I'll go about my business. And yet when people come for me, I'm like, okay, so who are you? Now I have to ask that question, because there's no reason to come for me. There's like you can disagree with what I'm saying, and you can operate in civil discourse, but if you're coming for me and insulting me, and people like who are supposed to be my friends, and you're doing it publicly, you're not privately going, Francis, why have you said that? Then that's a tell for me.
Francis, I feel exactly the same way. I mean, even though I've got a reasonable following, I kind of think, why would anyone come for me? And I do consider that a tell, because I mean, okay, I used to be someone. I mean, I used to have a profile, and I can see what I've understood about the rulers of the darkness of this world. They don't like apostates. I mean, or they don't like people who were a key part of their system, albeit unwittingly, who suddenly say, hang on a second, it was all a sham. They don't. So I can see why that, but my following, I mean, it ought to be huge, because I'm great and lovely and entertaining and stuff, but it's not, because I've been very, very, very heavily censored in every which way. So it seems to me that the only people I'm a threat to are the enemy. So I suppose, can I be annoying? Maybe I can do it, but I don't think I do anything that any genuinely awake person who's not compromised would object to, because I just go out there and make my podcasts and ask questions and write kind of zappy articles occasionally, but I don't think I do anything that is deleterious to our cause.
Can I get my elephant out of the room, out of the way?
Yeah, do. Get your...
I say this with some discomfiture, right? So, this is not about you, but it's like, we've met people, haven't we? And we've socialized with them to some extent. We go to events and we see them there, and obviously... Recently, there was this thing about Ed the Techie. Did you see all this? Oh, you might have been away on holiday.
I think there was a character I never met, and I'm always slightly suspicious of these people who presented to me as heroes of the resistance that I've never met, because normally we meet each other. That's how I met you. Carry on. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's this a chap called Ed the Techie who nobody knows really. I came across him only because he was a staunch defender of the Lucy Connolly psychological operation.
Yeah.
And he was bolstering that story, and he was attacking Miri about it. Miri had written articles exposing what we see as the fakery of the Lucy Connolly story. And he was enraged by this and was abusive and foul-mouthed in response, and telling people they should shut down and so on. So you have his card marked from there. And that's and yet, so he's apparently recently died. And then... It's Bob. Bob wrote a big eulogy about him and made him a cartoon, and a big long eulogy, like celebrating this chap at the Techie. So you think, maybe Bob doesn't know, but Bob presumably has seen what we've seen about the Lucy Connolly thing, but maybe he hasn't. So then you think, so we query it and we raise it, and Bob. Now this guy at the Techie, we look into him, and he's it's, so it's again subjective, right? Not funny, not interesting, not particularly, there's nothing remarkable about this guy. He's just some guy, some middle-aged guy who tweets about stuff, and he's on the wrong side of lots of things, like the Lucy Connolly. He does a podcast that has like 100 views or something with a guy called Sergeant Grumpy, who's actually a policeman, and they sound like policemen, and they seem like, and if you wanted to organize a little gaggle of people to discredit the cause, you'd get this ragtag bunch of people together. And so why is Bob eulogizing about this guy and saying things like big passage about him, about how he's...
A quick word from our sponsor.
Global warming is a massive con. There is no evidence whatsoever that man-made climate change is a problem, that it's going to kill us, that we need to amend our lifestyle in order to deal with it. It's a non-existent problem. But how do you explain this stuff to your normie friends? Well, I've just brought out the revised edition of my 2012 classic book, Watermelons, which captures the story of how some really nasty people decided to invent the global warming scare in order to fleece you, to take away your freedoms, to take away your land. It's a shocking story. I wrote it, as I say, in 2011, actually, the first edition came out. And it's a snapshot of a particular era, the era when the people behind the climate change scam got caught red-handed, tinkering with the data, torturing till it screamed, in a scandal that I helped christen ClimateGate. So I give you the background to the skullduggery that went on in these seats of learning where these supposed experts were informing us, we've got to act now. I rumbled their scam. I then asked the question, okay, if it is a scam, who's doing this and why? It's a good story. I've kept the original book pretty much as is, but I've written two new chapters, one at the beginning and one at the end, explaining how it's even worse than we thought. I think it still stands up. I think it's a good read. Obviously I'm biased, but I'd recommend it. You can buy it from jamesdellingpole.co.uk/shop. You'll probably find that. Just go to my website and look for it, jamesdellingpole.co.uk. And I hope it helps keep you informed and gives you the material you need to bring round all those people who are still persuaded that, oh, it's a disaster, we must amend our ways and appease the gods, appease Mother Gaia. No, we don't. It's a scam.
Now, back to the Delling Pod.
Now, this guy, Ed Ateker, we look into him, and it's again, subjective, right? Not funny. Not interesting, not particularly, there's nothing remarkable about this guy. He's just some guy, some middle-aged guy who tweets about stuff, and he's on the wrong side of lots of things, like the Lucy Connolly. He does a podcast that has like 100 views or something with a guy called Sergeant Grumpy, who's actually a policeman. And they sound like policemen, and they seem like, and if you wanted to organize a little gaggle of people to discredit the cause, you'd get this ragtag bunch of people together. And so why is Bob eulogizing about this guy and saying things like big passage about him, about how he was always right. He was on the moral side. He was on the right, consistently right. He was one of the most consistently right tweeters, and he was on the he was moral, and he was on the right side of things. Well, he wasn't consistently right, and he wasn't moral because he was trying to shut down questioning. So he was clearly no ally of the truth if he's trying to shut down questioning of things. And then Mary's husband Mark posted and asked him about and was querying it. And Charlotte, who's another suspect character, I wasn't going to name these earlier, but the people are like there's a circle of people around Albie Roberts and Charlotte who I don't trust anymore. And Charlotte asked Sonia and Bob to come to her rescue and explain why Ed was so great. And Bob comes into the tweet thing and usually with Bob as well, he doesn't celebrate other people on his Twitter. It's for the most part, he writes his own opinions and he shares his own cartoons. And he only really interacts with people to defend the statements that he's previously made or the cartoons he's made when people attack them. Like if someone comes at him about the Israel cartoon, he might a pithy and often scathing and articulate response, which demonstrates a side of his character you don't often see in person, this kind of almost controlled, fiery anger, like he sort of scorches people, you know. Like, I'm looking at thinking, what is your connection to Ed the Techie? Now, the context of this Ed the Techie thing was that the outpouring of supposed grief was so over the top and disproportionate to the guy's reach and his output, that's what initially got our attention. And also, Bob the man had died at 5 o'clock in the morning, and by 7 o'clock in the evening, Bob had got a cartoon for him and written a big eulogy and also announced this news to Twitter. It wasn't the family who announced it. Bob announced it before the family. The whole thing seems strange. Like, what is the connection here? So obviously the guy made online remarks and modified Bob's cartoons. He would put in what he called a vlandel, a candle with Zelensky on it, into Bob's artworks. And Bob he didn't like people tampering with his artworks. He has made that explicit before, that you shouldn't tamper with his artworks. You can share them, you can use them. It has to have his, you know, you don't color out his signature or anything like that. But this guy would modify them, and Bob's apparently got used to this and maybe met the guy at one of his book signings. So why the big eulogy and why the big outpouring of grief for this guy, and why so close that you know about the news on the same day? I just don't understand it. So we've asked the question and the answers haven't been satisfactory. But even without Bob in it, this guy, Ed the Techie, us questioning it generated a lot of pushback. And I don't get pushback about anything because I don't have a big audience. We can discuss like dead babies. We can discuss like Jamie Bulger or Dunblane shootings, the shootings of children, and we can question those. But questioning Ed the Techie got us this massive pushback because he's connected to Lucy Connolly. And this is a really important point I'll just finish on, is that you can question lots of things, but once the operation is done, then it doesn't matter anymore. And so there's no emphasis or importance attached to it, because within the first 2 or 3 months of the, maybe even shorter, the narrative gets lodged in the public mind, as we saw with the lockdowns. And after that, it's very difficult to change people's mind. I think that's why our war is so difficult. Like, it would be easier if we could just all take up arms and start shooting one another. But changing people's minds is way, way, way more difficult. And so, when the operation is not finished and it hasn't culminated and they haven't achieved the goals for it, then it's precious. And so when you're pointing out that Ed the Techie is part of this, and he was part of the Lucy Connolly story because he was saying, I've got her address, I'm communicating with in prison, you can get your address through me, and so on. He is a thread to be pulled at, just like Lucy Connolly is a thread to be pulled at, because they've got goals to either get, you know, Andy Burnham into parliament, or there's the restore and the reform angle to it, because she seems to be supporting reform or figurehead for that. And there's a polarization of white indigenous people against Muslims, and also right against left. And Lucy Connolly is part of the stoking of these adversarial positions. And so why is Bob engaged with Ed the Techie? That's my question.
Whoa, that is a huge, huge elephant. I mean, that's almost squashed me against the wall. I love Bob.
Right. My disclaimer or my thing is that, like, so I've just spoken. My position is, I will speak about anyone. I have to do this because otherwise I become controlled myself. Speak about anyone without fear or favor, okay? So I'm speaking there without fear or favor about something I don't understand. I can't make categoric accusations or conclusions. I found the explanations to be unsatisfactory. Bob has never done anything wrong to me. I've got no axe to grind. He's made a valuable contribution. I've never disagreed with much of what he said. But then in the context of, like, if I was to be suspicious of him, so this is if I was, and it's not coming from any other place. Again, I'm just speaking as an independent voice. So I go on his website and look at all the paintings that he sold, and I tot up the amount of money that's come in the past few years. So it's £1,125,000 just for the paintings, before the prints or the books.
Well, they are bloody good paintings. I mean, I don't begrudge anyone.
I'm not begrudging him money. I'm not begrudging him the money. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying, as someone, so if you were going to buy, let's say you're in the conspiracy world, and we would all recognize that the conspiracy world is smaller than the normie world, for want of a better expression. We're a smaller sect, so we're a smaller group of people. And then you have to find buyers in that group of people who are so interested in cartoonist work that they will pay more than the usual rate for cartoons, to the point that they're paying the amount you would pay for maybe old masters' works on paper. Or, you know, for example, there's a guy called Jan Six who was painted by Rembrandt in the 1600s. And he's now, there's a Jan Six in every family subsequently. So I think it's like Jan Six, the 16th currently. But this, the current alive Jan Six, he's really interested in the history of Rembrandt. And so he's got become like an art historian, and he tries to find undiscovered Rembrandts. So he recently got a dealer or an investor to spend £100,000 on what he thinks is an original Rembrandt. And he's going to prove it with, you know, once he's got the painting in his hands with, you know, analysis and so on. So you can actually get an oil on canvas that might be a Rembrandt for £100,000, and Bob is selling things for £75,000. Not all his work is £75,000, but also if you wanted to buy works on paper by old masters, like not the top ranked ones like Michelangelo or Raffaello stuff, you'd be getting them at the prices that Bob is selling at. But so it's, to me, it seems, I thought this was plausibly deniable. I thought, well, he's from the Telegraph and maybe he's just got lots of rich buyers. But I there were so many sales. I went through, I don't know how many lines are on a piece of A4 paper, but I was onto my fourth column. So that's like maybe 75 sales, 85 sales in the thousands of pounds. And I know the art world's funny, and you artists do sell for thousands of pounds, but the conspiracy circle to make it, it could just be that, because one of my questions is, James, so I'm not trying to attack Bob, I'm trying to understand. So one of my questions to divide who is right and who's wrong, and right, is have they suffered personally or professionally for their position? And you could say that Bob has because he got sacked, but then you could also say that he hasn't because he's just made £1 million. Or you could, and that's just from paintings. And I mean, I know he's had expenditures for the shows, and he maybe didn't make a profit on some of his shows or the book, but he sold the book and the prints. So we're looking at around that figure. And then, and also the other thing that happens with these people is that they have a very public encounter with the oppositional force, whether it's an arrest or a sacking. So like Abby Roberts, I was present at Abby Roberts' arrest, and I was. And, you know, when you're with a friend, you can overlook some of their foibles or strangenesses, but you still, and you think, oh, let's say if you're in a relationship with a girlfriend, and you overlook a few anomalies because you're in love with them, or like because you're friendly with them. And then you think, oh, so that all makes sense now when I see it. When I felt that at the time, I didn't really understand what was going on there. So when I was watching Abby Roberts get arrested, the first thing was, it was at the inquiry, into the COVID, the official inquiry, and there were different people arriving on different days, and so she came down for the Matt Hancock day, but we'd been there once before, and we tried to walk behind the TV cameras, which were set up on a slight embankment on the corner where you have trees growing out of and things, like there was a like muddy embankment with a little raised wall, and they moved us instantly from behind the cameras. They didn't want the yellow boards behind the cameras. The security came out and moved us. When Abby did it, they allowed her to be there for it, so I followed her in. And so the two of us are there waving the yellow boards behind the GB News reporter. Then, so that was a bit weird anyway, because they weren't very quick today to get rid of us. Then the police and the security came out and said, you can't be in this space. This is private property. You can be there on the embankment. You can be on the pavement. You can't be behind the cameras. And so they started arguing, and the policeman didn't say, come on, I understand you're here to protest. He wasn't like a conciliatory, which is what they're supposed to do. They have that process that they go through. What is it? The four, five, it's like five Ds or something, like de-escalate and all this stuff. So he doesn't do that. He escalates it. He says, if you swear again to Abby, because she's like, it's an effing democide or something like this. And he's like, if you swear again, I'll arrest you. So he basically dares her to challenges her and provokes her to do something that will get arrested. So in that position, most normal people would be, I don't think I'm I don't want to be arrested, so I'll just move on to the pavement. It's only a couple of yards away and carry on doing what I'm doing, and I won't be arrested and we can do what we're doing. So she swears. So I thought that was the second weird thing. And then she says, I'm re-arresting you. So normally when I've seen arrests happen in the lockdown era or the post-lockdown era, they get rid of them straight away so that you don't create a kerfuffle. They just say, come on, come with me, we'll take you to the van, do the details, whatever. They tell you your rights or whatever, and you're out of the way very quickly, and the police ring fence you, like they make a little huddle around you so that your friends can't come and pull you away or anything or get involved. They didn't do any of this. They just let her turn around. And because then there was a kerfuffle, the media, who were all looking for photographs of people coming and going from the COVID inquiry, came and made a ring around Abby while she pontificated to the media. So I thought, this is very strange as well. And I'm filming now, because as soon as the police came out, I start filming, because you get like, you can get 10 or 100 times the views on a video with police in it, right? So I became aware of that during the lockdown. So I was filming, keeping my mouth shut so I don't crash the sound, because I'm using my phone. And I'm watching these things, thinking that's odd and that's odd, but I think that she's okay at this point. And then eventually they arrest her and they take her away and they walk her along the front of the building, past the car park at the front, and they take her to where the police vehicles are. And she's going to get put in a police van, and it's a narrow entrance. And she says, she says really authoritatively, "I'm not going in there. I'm claustrophobic." And instead of saying, "Well, you should have thought that before you got arrested," they say, "Okay, we'll put you in a minibus," and they put her in a minibus. So then at that point, I'm in a position where, what should I go to the station with Abby? But there's the yellow board said, and there's only a small number of us, like say four or five. And they're saying, "Oh, just stay, because we've only got a small number and we need someone." So then I stayed for a bit. And also she calls me while I stay and says, "Everything's fine. I'll be let out in an hour." And they give me a cup of tea. The police have been very nice to me. So I'll be out in about an hour. So I thought, I've got about an hour. So then I set off and go to the police station. And when I get there, I haven't told this part of the story, but I've only said this story once to Leo recently, but this part of the story I haven't. I went and pressed the intercom at Holborn Police Station and said, "I'm looking for," and this, "What's the name of the person you're looking for?" I said, "Abby Roberts," and they didn't have a clue what I was talking about. They said, "Abby who?" And I was trying to remember her married name, and I was thinking, and then I looked it up and trying to find my married name, said, "Is it under this name?" And they have a clue what I'm talking about. So then they said, I spoke to the police and said, can you ask for me about this lady? And eventually it got, so I was through the policeman that I found out that through the policeman entering and coming out, they started to give me stories like, "Oh yeah, she's being processed or something." So I start to wait. And then, you wait, the sunk cost fallacy. So I keep waiting, because I figure I've waited this long, they must be out at any minute now. So I wait till about 8 o'clock at night. And then the police start saying to me, she's probably not going to be out. And I was like, "Well, why?" She said, "It'd be an hour," and it's like ages now. And then eventually they made up the story, or they told me the story of the fact that she's going to be out. They're holding her in because they're doing something. I forget what act it was. It was terrorism act or something. They said it was more serious. They made it more serious, so they had to hold her in overnight. So now I can look at that whole story and question what was going on. Like, why was she not there? Why did they not let her out? Was it because she wasn't in there? Where did she go? I don't know anything about that story. Because now that you don't trust somebody, you don't know any part of their story is true or not. I can't tell you. Then later on, she writes this whole... And the next day, they invited me to her... Charlotte was in London for some reason and was at Abby's, and they invite me to the flat. So I go to the flat and it was last minute. So I had to sort of hot-foot it across London, because I thought she'd probably want to go to bed early because she's been out at the police station all night. And I get hot-foot across London and... It's hot and sweaty. It's a day like today. So I'm like, they seem very heightened. There was very like heightened atmosphere, and they were enjoying themselves and laughing a lot and all this stuff. And I thought she might be upset and subdued because she'd been arrested and stuff. And they were up. And then Charlotte pulls out a picture and takes a picture of me. And I'm still like weighing people up. I don't know if I'm going to fall out with them in 2 minutes or they're going to have the wrong opinion on something. And I don't want to validate people unnecessarily. So take a picture of me. And I thought, well, it doesn't matter. It's probably just for private. It's on the internet by the time I get home. What to make of that now. I'm like, they seem very happy and like they were celebrating. And I was so, and then, yeah, I don't know. Don't know. But,
well, Francis, that is an awful lot to process. And I'm not going to censor you. I'm not going to pull this interview because it's not, I don't do no. conversations. But you can see, I love Bob so much, and you know, you're talking about people who certainly, I mean, I've had good times together and stuff,
exactly,
and shared intimacies, I suppose.
But can I just jump in there? Can I just say one thing? But so did the animal rights people, women who had babies with police, not knowing that they were police.
So I'm just going to briefly connect this to my views on UK column. I know that there's a certain, I think a lot of people going this would be going, will be saying, well, why are we engaging in this traitor hunting and stuff? This is counterproductive, which is partly my feeling, why can't we all get along, first of all? And secondly, shouldn't we turning our focuses to the Illuminati or whatever. But there will be others who are going, Dellingpole, the fact that you are so relatively unconcerned about the expose of Marcel Janker, the German, the mysterious German, and the pro-China direction of UK column, and Debbie Evans's and Sandy Adams's expose. How can, well, the truth is, I don't watch. I think I said this before. I don't watch. I haven't got time to watch podcasts, especially not stuff which makes me uncomfortable. I like Sandy very, very much. I think she's completely kosher. I don't think I've met Debbie, or may have done, but I have no reason to distrust anything she says. So it's not that. It's more a sort of, I like the things that I find interesting, and the things that don't, I kind of think, well, life's too short to be, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And of course there's that layer of, I know some of the people from UK column. I've done a few podcasts with Germ Warfare. I get on very well with him. Alex Thompson, I'm very fond of. He's erudite and fascinating. And I've spoken to sorry, my brain's gone in the heat. Submarine guy,
Mike. Are you talking about people from UK column?
Like, yeah, yeah.
Alex Thompson, Mike, and Brian Gerrish.
Who's the main guy?
Brian Gerrish.
Brian. So I had a great time with Brian at the that first Hope Festival, which, by the way, I have to say, were you there?
No.
I love that festival, but I now think that was about as infiltrated as it was almost like the... Yeah. I wonder now if there are more infiltrators there than there were actual...
That's what I think.
Really, actually.
Yeah. This is why I think.
Really? I mean, it's weird. I was one of the guys I met since we're naming names, was Darren Nesbitt from The Light. And Daz was like, you know, yeah, I'm an old hand and you know, this is some of the stuff you need to learn. And I was thinking, yeah, a wise guru, I like you, and I like what the Light Player's doing, and I like your jolly song that you're talking about, that we are the 99%. Was that his song?
Yeah.
I think it.
Well, he plays it. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And so I wouldn't have mentioned this, but on Substack recently, he put out this in the comments. He put. Let me find it, because I don't think people should be able to get away. Well, I mean, I suppose I should have just gone and shrugged my shoulders and said, hold on.
Just while you find it, if I may.
Carry on.
I've got loads of things on different people, but on the couple of points you just raised there. So the first one is, I think I disagree with you, and probably quite strongly, about whether it's right or wrong to look into UK column, because and people like that. I kind of agree with one side of what you're saying, but the part in which I disagree is that no one should be above scrutiny, and the whole deception, as I mentioned before, worked on the basis that people trusted people who they shouldn't have trusted. The whole deception of lockdowns and every psychological operation we talk about, whether it's all the way back to World War One or World War Two or 9/11, people trust people who they shouldn't be trusting. And so the people who are deceiving us are not always obvious. They're more difficult to discern. And so if there is a thread to be pulled out about funding and the kind of people they're employing, or a change of editorial line because after a certain person emerged from nowhere, then those questions have to be asked. I don't think we should spare the questions, because I think you've mentioned, I listened to your podcast, and you talk about there was a fellow on, was it Peter Duke, talking about how logos and the discourse, that's how we find the truth. That's the, and so
yeah,
we have to discuss these things and resolve them, and it has to be aired in the open. And if there's nothing, like, people could ask me anything about what I'm doing, and I'd be quite happy to discuss it with them. If they're just going to attack me and say that I'm without evidence, then I can dismiss it without evidence. But if someone came to me and said something like, there's this much money in your bank account, Francis, well, there's barely any money in my bank account, but if they were to put some in, I'd be able to explain it. But do you see what I mean? You have to be open.
I found the thing, by the way, which I'll reach in a moment. But on that point you've just made, I think you'll find that I disagree with you far less than you thought I was. It's not that I'm saying that it's not legitimate to ask these questions. Of course it is. I'm trying to explain to people that the fact that I personally am not getting excited and going, yes, we found another traitor, it's not indicative that I'm covering for their arses and that I too am compromised. It's more a sort of, it's more that sort of that thing I mentioned right at the beginning about me being trusted and wanting to believe well of everybody. I find it upsetting.
Yeah, it is upsetting. I found it affecting, because I want to trust all these people, and you want to make friends with them, and you think you found your tribe, and then you think, oh, they're all duplicitous.
Exactly. Okay, so this is what Daz posted this on Substack, unprompted. Dellingpole is classic MI5 and very odd in a not good way. Well, I mean, how am I classic MI5? I don't know. Is that, I went to Oxford.
I've got a question for Daz. I want to know how it's possible to set up and print a newspaper and who funds it in the darkest days of 2020 and have it out so early. I want to know how he still gets the gold adverts for his thing, where you think they wouldn't touch his newspaper because it's a conspiracy site, those kind of financial gold adverts he put in the back of it. I'm not sure about the whole Daz business. I'm not sure about any of them. Well, where have they come from, these people? Who are they?
This is where I say tu quoque. I mean, I think I hadn't really been wanting to believe ill of him or suspect him. But when somebody fingers you as an MI5 agent,
right,
and you know that you're not,
right,
and your brother knows you're not, and your sister knows you're not, and anyone, you start thinking, well, hang on, why would you say that? I mean, I don't know.
So my brother JP he used to edit Red Issue, which was a football magazine for Manchester United. And so he knows what it takes to put out a publication once a month. And so he says there is absolutely no conceivable way that you could get a newspaper up and running as a one-man band distributed in the middle of lockdown and have it out I don't know exactly with the month it came out, but it was not long after lockdown. And also, why would you call it The Light? Like, The Light makes it look like it's some kind of religious paper, and it also has Freemasonic connotations. So, and also with the stuff they put in it, they're like, they put articles in there that are laced with things that I don't think we can substantiate. Or also the headlines are sometimes like, you're all going to die at a jab, but it's kind of really hard hitting. And if it's an attempt to convert people and engage them, why is it so kind of, what would I would say, offensive to normies at times?
So here you are, Francis. You've taken me. Okay, it was my fault for asking you the questions, and indeed even having you on my podcast. But I was not expecting. Well, you know, I wasn't expecting, because I don't prepare these things. I wasn't expecting. You said, "Shall we just? What do you want to do?" And I said, "You said, do you want to just freestyle it?" And I said, "Yeah, much more my."
I've got one little thing to say. I've got quite a few people that we could talk about, and I think it's time to just say stuff. But first of all, let's talk about Debbie Evans. I'll get my little point about her out of the way. So in my experience of her, she's been fine, as I mentioned, but also she always pushes David A. Hughes, and I don't trust David A. Hughes as far as I can throw him, because and I tried to highlight this last time I was on with you, and I mentioned that he has this idea of Camp 1, Camp 2, Camp 3, and this is what Debbie's always pushing, but I think that's a completely spurious way of assessing. It's not completely flawed, but it's pretty flawed, because you could divide people into four camps, and it's arbitrary. You have to take each case on its merit. Well, somebody might be a completely authentic truth seeker, and then on one issue they have a different opinion to you. So it's a way of, like you say, of creating you. Do they float? Is the thing? Do they float? Well, they're not camp three. It's complete like a witch finding thing, isn't it? Like, if they sink, they're a witch, and so on.
Well, that's what he seems to have appointed himself, witch finder general.
But who is he?
And I was like, why? Who are you? Can I just make one point on that one? One very brief point one. He constantly flaunts his PhD. Now, anyone who's awake knows that the academic bauble system is completely bankrupt. So it's a bit like calling yourself Doc, being a podcast calling yourself Doc. Why would you flaunt the credentials which are only valued in the corrupt system that we're all against? Why would you do that?
Well, he came for me twice, as you know, and wrote a couple of articles about me, which I thought was strange because I'm a nobody. And then...
You are. I mean, in the nicest possible way. Yeah, you are. Why would you attack you?
I want to be somebody, but I'm still nobody. But anyway, the point is that he wrote about me, but then that's why I looked at him and kept an eye on him and looked at his Substack. And he was doing a GoFundMe for his child who had some kind of illness or long-term disability kind of illness. And so he wanted to buy a chair. So the chair cost £3,000, but so he raised the money and kept the fundraiser open until he got £15,000, and then shut it when it was like, so that's fine. But then I thought, well, let's suppose I'm a dad and I've got a child with a disability, serious disability, and I'm working and I've got some kind of job or tenure at a university. What is the likelihood of me ditching that job? So he must be very principled. He must be a very principled guy to ditch his university job when he's got a family to take care of. He must be very principled. That's all I'm saying. So principled.
Do you want to get anything off your chest about me? I mean, do you have, I need it to trust anybody, but are the things about me that don't make sense?
You've asked me this question before, but I think that the main thing is obviously if you profile people and you look at where they came from. So you're the last man standing that I haven't got major questions on, in the sense of, you say things that I agree with and this and that, but all the people that came from GB News Talk Radio and what was the other one? These kind of outlets. What would the other one be?
TNT.
TNT, yeah. All the people that have come down to us from those. And I say all, but I obviously don't know all of them. I haven't looked at all of them. The ones that I'm aware of, I don't really trust any of them. The ones who appeared as anti-lockdown voices at that time. I mean, even if you go back to people like Desmond Swain and Charles Walker and Peter Hitchens and these people, when they were speaking out about lockdown, they flipped and took us all to they all got the vaccine and said, "Oh, it's a waste of time. You need to get the vaccine." But by and large, I don't just judge it on these little anomalous things. I'm looking at authenticity in the way they speak and think, how could such and such speak like that if they were fake? You haven't done anything. If I was to query you, if the questions that arise is that it would be along the lines of, they seem to be pushing poles of Christianity against Muslims. So you have to have people very attached to Christianity to do that. If you're going to divide the country into have some kind of modern crusades.
Oh, that one, yeah.
Yeah, so you could, and the only other one is that because you've got that kind of maverick flippancy, you sometimes maybe give importance to stories maybe about, you know, like Paul McCartney or pandas and stuff like that could be perceived as maybe associating it with serious problems. Like, I say serious because all the deceit is serious, but things that maybe we've got an evidence base for or more of an evidence base for. But on the other hand, if you're a truth seeker, you will go down these different avenues. So what I'm saying is, if I start to talk about like the Ike problem, it's the Ike problem. If Ike says the Queen's a lizard, that's hard for people to believe. But if you talk about it's hard enough to believe that the jab was a depopulation shot. So if you get the same guy saying both those things, the normie population discredit the source. So if I, for example, talk about jabs, they go, "Oh, you're like David Ike." So for the more things we talk about, we can't quite, people find harder to believe, even if we can prove them, there's things like we mentioned Paul McCartney, it might be possible to prove that, I don't know, or the pandas or things that people find ridiculous, then they'll discredit everything you say. Which is a problem.
Yeah, I think I've fairly successfully addressed that.
Yeah, that I've read your
point in a few Substacks, and I put a lot of thought into them, and I'm very happy with the consistency of my arguments, and actually. I got some far support on Miri on that one, or indeed I quoted Miri. I mean, Miri is very much in the business of anyone who appoints themselves gatekeeper as to which right. opinions are allowed and which ones are not allowed must themselves be suspect, and also doesn't get the point. We're really year zero when we get in the rabbit hole. We're everything has to operate according to first principles, you know. And the first point is, everything I've been told about the world could potentially be a lie. Therefore, I should question everything, and not just vaccines, but also the true purpose of the Beatles. And it seems to me that particularly, I mean, I'm sort of just briefly paraphrasing my articles on the subject, but it seems to, one of the things that I find particularly interesting, because I think I've got, because of my education and my leanings, I'm quite interested on how cultures are formed, how people are moved in different directions. Talking, be a cultural criticism, I suppose, cultural analysis. And if, as I think we both accept, the world is run by a narrow elite that runs billion, I don't know whether there are 9 billion of us, 8 billion of us, I think that's a lie, but a lot of us and very few of them, how do they control us? Well, it's kind of key to their control mechanism that they capture the popular culture, which is, and you think, who were the biggest and most influential band in history? The Beatles. What were they trying to achieve? They were trying to divide the generations. That's one of their favorite divide and rules, one of their favorite techniques. To break down the family, to encourage drug use, to all these things. And so when you start analyzing the journey that they took us on through the Beatles, from She Loves You, Yeah, 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 to going to the Maharishi and Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. And I mean, in the space of 10 years, they got people who were clean living, you know, probably would have been like their parents, more like their parents, and they turn them into these long-haired hippies with round glasses, dropping LSD and having group sex and not delaying the family and stuff. So I would argue that Paul is Dead and related stuff is as important in its way, and indeed Pandas, as Don't Take the Vaccine.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly the you can't argue that you should be allowed to question everything. You can't argue about the influence of the Tavistock Institute. You can't argue about the influence of popular culture. Leo was very upset with us with the Panda question, in terms of, like, for example, because he thinks it's absolute, but then it's okay to question it.
Of course, he does, because he's Leo and he's got a specific. It's his. No one likes having their baby being told that their baby isn't pretty.
Well, I mean, if you've got first-hand experience, he went and got first-hand experience of him. But let's say, but for
he
example,
shagged a panda.
I don't think he did that. Although that's what the people there was
and a Chinese man inside said, "Oh, do not do that."
It's interesting that Owen Benjamin pushes the panda thing, and he's just been on with Tucker Carlson, and I would say that would be a tell for people, because
Francis, I can tell you, if I know I should be saying I don't want to be on Tucker's show because he's evil and he's CIA, and he probably is, but I just like the experience. I mean, and that wouldn't mean that I'm, it just means I'm.
True. You're not guilty by talking to somebody. It's just the fact that they would amplify you to that extent. You probably won't get amplified by Tucker Carlson.
I probably won't.
But Tucker Carlson for me is an absolute wrong'un. So he's absolute from the 9/11 days onwards. And his whole thing, I've just woken up, people were telling him, and he was withholding footage of Building 7 on his own show. Absolute wrong'un. So the fact that obviously they might engage with some people like us, like people have done with us, like, so, to leech our authenticity. So Owen might get, you know, a pass potentially. I don't know, but I don't know. I don't trust a lot of
We all have our weaknesses like, though, don't we, Francis? Yeah. I mean, that's what we've established. Especially if you're, I don't know. I mean, I think you are you are probably righter than me in the sense that you are more sensible than me. And probably what you're saying is more true. I mean, in the sense that I think wiser than me is probably the adjective I'm reaching for. But then of course you and I have different personality makeups, and I can't help being slightly kind of
provocative
and puppyish and kind of, it's just like, and flippant and irreverent, I'm just, this is how I came out. So I hope I can be forgiven for not sharing your austerity
I'm quite flippant and irreverent but I've been burned so many times, like personally before all this 2020 business. Like I found out at the weekend that one of my cousins thinks of me like as a Holocaust denier. That's the way they characterize me, my views, and there's
when they've been trained.
Yeah, so there's probably a distance between me and people in my family that I wasn't aware of because that they've encountered my views in different ways. And it's like, okay, that's what they think of me. Okay, well, but I didn't know this. I heard this from my brother. My brothers have woken up now, so they see the world in a very similar way. So they're just saying, okay, they still think of you like that. I was like, okay. But my brothers are not thought of like that, but we pretty much see the world the same way now.
Just going back to one particular point, which I think, I don't know whether you've got any thoughts on. I very much share your suspicions about academic PhD guy. There's certain things that don't make sense. And I think he's very much part of that kind of infiltrate and divide thing. But at the same time, he's done good work exposing, his three million word expose of Rainer Fulmich and his thing on Marcel Janker and stuff. It's clearly stuff that needed to get out there. How can he be a wrong and doing important work?
It's possible that he just has a different outlook to me, and it's possible these things are possible. Yeah, you have to, like, I have to reserve the possibility, which is why I've pointed in a certain direction with him and with whoever we've spoken about, say I need these questions answering, but it's possible that he just sees things differently to me, and there's space for those people in the world. But I also think it's so interesting that Well, he's come for you as well, hasn't he? And he's come for me. And
he's come for me. Yeah. Because I went to Russia.
But yeah. I'm so I don't want to say cynical, but I need reasons. So I'm thinking, well, why is this being detonated now? What are we distracting from? Because they really didn't like us talking about Ed the Techie and Lucy Connolly, and that's an ongoing operation. So they could have talked about Debbie Evans left the UK column in 2024, Sandy Adams left in 2025, and it does take a while to, lick your wounds and get your evidence together and come through. So it just could all be natural. It could be completely organic. But it could also be like, we need something to get them arguing over here, because there's people who are alive to the fact that many things are a deception. And if they're all looking at some internecine squabbling at UK column, then they're not looking at what's happening with Reform or the next Prime Minister or the Lucy Connolly or whatever these things are. So, and it may be that some of the protagonists in it aren't aware that this is what is happening. Like there will be people operating in good faith, just as there always are, like in any operation. But I have doubts about David, obviously, about David A. Hughes. And the other thing is that I notice about these people many of them, there's a few things that I maybe could speak generally that you can look at with people, and it's how prolific they are. It's almost like first of all, let's go through a few things. I've said before, disinformation is 95% true, otherwise no one will believe it. Secondly, they're getting paid, so they're prolific because they don't have to worry about work. And also maybe in the case of David A. Hughes, you could argue he's got family to support, so he's got to work really hard to get, because he's now supporting his family solely by contributions from the benevolence of his Substack audience. He thought it was a good idea to support his family through Substack. Then you have things like some of the people that we follow are going to be, they have backstories and sick children and grief, or they've lost the husband or the dad or the son, and then it makes it difficult to question them. Because you heartless beast, how could you question this person? They're obviously upset because, you know, like, for example, Abby was upset. Any anomalous behavior from Abby, you can say, well, she's lost a mum and a husband in recent times. And she might have, but I don't know anything about Abby except what she's told me, and I don't trust her. So I don't know what's true and what's not. And then she's...
Although, wait, Francis, point here. What about my ruse of letting my dad die?
No, but this is not, obviously things are real, but and I, that's not what I was drawing attention to. But
teasing you.
I get you. But there are people who will take you seriously. I get the joke, but like by way of explanation, it wasn't an excuse for you at any point in the past 6 years and longer. It was never an excuse for how you behaved. It's just something that's happened a lot. It's incidental. But for some of these people, it's a pivotal part of their narrative. For example, there's one lady called Trudy, and I don't know if her story is true. She's part of the circle of people around Abby who I don't trust anymore. And again, I'm presenting the information for people to make their own minds up, and I'm not declaring one way or the other. Her son committed suicide in 2020. Okay. But then she was amplified by the BBC in the past year for, you know, suicide awareness things. She was brought a big report about her, which is an unusual thing to happen to someone who's quite a vocal dissident, because they don't know what she's going to say, or they don't know. And you don't want to draw attention to these people in case people follow them and then see what they're saying about other stuff. It's not usual. So when you're looking at these things, the deception is so deep, and they're callous. They're not like us, where they play upon our sensibilities, whether it's like saving granny or, you know, or any of these kind of saving the planet or don't eat meat because it's saving animals. These they play upon our sensibilities because we have them, and they're cynical. So if you're going to put a parade of people to amplify or to celebrate, the thing I'm trying to say is they cross fertilize each other. So they're always sharing each other. So Fiona Rose Diamond and Abby will be the same with Debbie Hicks, who accused me of sexually harassing her. They're all Fiona Rose Diamond's birthday party on in the park in London. So, and then they amplify each other's thing. Or Abby will say, "If you come to my comedy show after you've been to Tommy Robinson's march," or they post these things and they share. There's a nexus. There's a hidden organization of people where they cross promote each other. And so some of these are lesser, like than the profile of your Abbeys and your Tommy Robinsons and your Fiona Rose Diamonds, because you need a sense of them getting adulation. Oh, this is the person we should follow. So you put people in there at a lower level who are just faces on the internet, who like Ed the Techie or who supports Lucy Connolly. And so if he's got any kind of small scale following, like they will trust him over, because he was against the lockdowns and against the vaccines. So you have people, and if they've got a sympathetic backstory, it makes you believe them all the more. For example, this is I just watched Debbie Evans and Sandy Adams, and they were talking about how they mentioned Eaton, and how what's the fella's name, the ex-policeman who's a UK column now, he got Brian Gerrish or one of the guys into speak to Eaton, and so he's called Charles something. What's he called? I'm thinking Charles Walker, but he's Charles something.
Charles Mallett.
Mallett, that's it, yeah. Mr. Mallett.
I've got him on the podcast next week.
Have you? Right. Well, I'll tell you about Eaton. So there's a woman who's also got a poorly child who got me to... she said, "Francis, can you come and get involved in a film? I want to make a film about how people are getting vaccinated, or forced vaccinated. The state is trying to vaccinate people and care people with vulnerabilities, and they're taking the decision off the parents." And initially, she invited me to the court case, and it was her and Abby, and I sat through the court case, and afterwards, I wrote a write-up on it, because someone suggested to me you should write about this. So I wrote about it, and it was like one of my most shared things, and Bob shared it, but it was something of mine, the only thing that Bob shared of mine. So then she says, "Yeah, can you come to my house?" And they lived in Windsor, so I went to Windsor, and there was meant to be there were people there, and now I don't trust virtually everybody. Well, there's a couple that I do trust, but there's virtually everyone on the table I'm not sure about that was there, and they were discussing how to make a film about vaccination. So I was okay. And I felt this, but I thought it was in a benign way. I felt set up, because I thought, well, he's going back to work, he's teaching, and he's a vicar, and they're parents of disabled children, so who's going to help with this? And I thought, I'm set up here, so they're going to ask me in a minute, they're going to ask me to help with this film. And I thought, well, I'll say yes until I have to say no. So if there's things I can do, like proofread a script or whatever, or edit, then I'll do that. But if it comes too much, I can always bail out later. So I thought, I'll do my best to help the cause. But I felt set up. And that instinct of being set up. So she asked everyone, and everyone said, "Well, I'm doing work." And she turns to me and goes, "Francis, will you help me edit it?" So then the workload got more and more. And she was asking me to read past court cases about the... And so I read them. And I'm quite good at in a short-term way, reading and retaining information and to get into the nooks of the matter and remembering the little quotes and making notes of it. But the, and then so eventually sent me the script. The script was terrible. Like, and it was like a joke. It was like if you wanted to discredit the movement. So I was like, no, we can't have that. We can't have that. We'll do this. And then it was on me then suddenly to find the filming locations, the casting. And then they also had to have it to get funding, or the funders disappeared miraculously. And one of the, so I, one of the times I was with them, but her husband worked at Eton. And so I thought, well, I said to him, he said he was going to ask for funding from the donors to Eton. And I said, you can't do that. You'll put your livelihood at risk. If one of these people is thinks you're a raging anti-vaxxer and you're teaching his kids, you might get sacked. And I was like worried for them.
Yeah.
But if it wasn't true, I had no need to be worried. And that's why they could say
Can you just hold that second? I've got to do something important to do with that. Wait,
and now back to James.
Thanks for waiting. I'm going to wind it up very soon. On the Eton point, I should mention, well, you know, my son went to Eton, so that could be another.
I completely accept. So, like, I lived in Oxford and met lots of students. It doesn't mean all of them are MI5, and so I get all that. But then, if I just round up that story, because I know you haven't got all day, but like, I was in this position, getting more and more work loaded onto me. And it started to annoy me, and I don't get easily annoyed. And also, she was calling me all the time in the daytime at 9 to 5. And I thought, well, I can't get work done if this is a sideline for me, this film.
Yeah.
So I asked her not to call me in the daytime. So for the next several days, she would just call me in the daytime. And I took a screenshot of all the missed calls every day. She was calling me in the daytime. So you'd call back out of politeness. And sometimes, and how the amount of times she said her child was calling me, and when she needs to get in touch with me, it was always the child who rang me. But the child seems to have stopped ringing me now for some reason. By accident. And the Eton thing was not just that he was at Eton. So I looked him up, and his dad was a close acquaintance. Like, he did a year like as a friend and shadowing the Queen because he was an artist. But this wasn't like something that really came up in conversation where he said, oh, Francis, you're an artist. You might want to know about my dad. He's not. He never mentioned it. But his dad was, they were that close to the Queen. And then I looked him up in terms of Eton, and he's talking about the use of AI and stuff in schools. And I would never have suspected these people, but then they seem to be part of this orbit around Abby. And then at one point, they were asking me to do the casting and all this sort of stuff and find locations to shoot. And I found a cafe where we could do the filming in. And they said, oh, no, we don't want to do it there. We want to do it at the venue where they had Comcast. I forget the name of the little village place, but they were all very fond of this place where they did Comcast. And I was thinking, Comcast anyway, like that seems to be full of people who had no right to be there. Like Andrew Lawrence, he wasn't anti-lockdown or anti-vaxxer and stuff like that. They were giving these guys money, and Comcast is CC like 33. So you're thinking, okay. And then the last bit of this is that when I fell out with Abby, and it was online, and she was making lots of swipes at me online about things, and she wasn't naming me all the time, but she was swiping at Miri and myself online and saying things like, she said that she took out a quote. I said, we were talking about if you deny questioning, then you're no longer an agent of truth. And she said that Abby said about us that we were engaged, calling ourselves agents of the truth and engaged in navel gazing wankery. And so that's not something you would say publicly about your friend. So I was like, okay. And then when, because there was no contact with Abby, and I'd identified all these people that I was suspicious of, and I just thought, I'm not going to engage with them and see what happens. I got a call from a guy called Steve who the lady doing the film, she was always saying he was going to do the filming. Of course, they all disappeared because it made more work for me to do the filming or find the cameras or learn how to do film school. Like, she was telling me to do a film course online so we could learn how to film it. I was like, what? Anyway, this guy, Steve, calls me out of the blue. And I thought, how did you get my number? I didn't know that I had given him my number. I was like, I never heard from him. And even when I saw him in the street, he just said hello and never really spoke to me about much. Like if I saw him at some demo or something. So then all of a sudden he was like, he said, can you get a message to Abby for me? And I was like, well, I've got all the same platforms that you've got. You've got her number. You've been on her show before. I've seen you. She's been on Twitter this morning. You've been on Twitter this morning. I've seen that. And so I was kind of, I was thinking, okay, this is the hook. So then I said to him, well, I don't think Abby's very happy with me at the moment. And he was like, all right, well, I'm going to go down and film the Graham Linehan thing at the end of the week. Graham Linehan was going into court for that psychological operation. He said, I was just wanting Abby to come along. And he said, you should come along as well and you get involved and whatnot. And I said, all right, okay. because I thought, well, I think that's a load of old baloney, so I'm not going to do that. I didn't say that to him, but I was like, oh, that's a load of old baloney. And then at the end of the week, he was there, and Graham Linehan was actually wearing this guy's sandwich board, this kind of pink and blue and white. They used the colours of one of the trans colours, and they put something that's offensive to trans people on it, or not offensive, they put the truth basically, but they put it in a provocative way because they're trying to provoke people in the street. But this whole sandwich board thing is something that Montgomery Toms does now. He does the same kind of thing. And this guy, Steve, is called Edge of the Matrix on Twitter. And I was thinking, why is this person trying to engage me with Abby, making me, he wanted me to call Abby up and re-establish communications. And things like this, just there's so much of it, like the and people will watch this, they'll just think I'm off my head and mad or whatever, but I'm pretty rational, and I've seen enough to give me reason to be suspicious of these people.
Well, this has been a very interesting, if depressing episode, which did the very thing kind of I find so upsetting, that like it's going to create more division, but we're truth seekers, so I mean we've got to ask questions, haven't we?
Yeah, I'm sorry about that, and it's not without some discomfiture, as I said, that I talk about these things, and I don't want to be the witch hunter guy or the guy who's setting people against one another. But the point is, and it's the key point, the only reason we have been deceived in the past is that because people have been able to deceive us. So I know that there are people, and there'll be people listening and people who follow you and whatnot. They think it's all, oh, I wish we'd all get along, and it's all bickering. It's not bickering. This is how you identify. This is where the rubber meets the road. Like when I saw Abby at a funeral, at Kathleen Fox's funeral recently, first of all, I was like, what are you doing here? Because I knew that I'd introduced her to Kathleen, so she couldn't really have known her, and she didn't seem that well disposed towards her. She was sort of taking the mickey. And I was saying, no, Kathleen's good value. You'd like to. So like I was sort of making, mollifying, because Kathleen was eccentric. So I was like, no, she was taking the mickey out of her. And I was like, well, I was trying to mollify that and say like, no, she's really good value. She's always got something to talk about with Kathleen, because I knew Kathleen from Yellow Boards. But then she was at the funeral. I was like, what's she doing now? No, she got invited by somebody. But then she was standing in front of me, and she was talking stuff that wasn't true in my face. And I was like, okay, so this is where we meet them face to face. We meet them face to face sometimes. Like she's telling me things that are not true. And she's trying to wave away all this abuse or this kind of friction and stuff that she said online, as though it doesn't matter. But that people who publicly insult you online are not your friends. So when they come and pretend to be your friend, as though that's not happened, you know there's a deception taking place. And I was looking into her eyes and watching a performance. That's what I was seeing. And then recently I spoke about Edda Techie. She came defending Bob on my Substack and wrote a million comments. And then as I held my own against her, she, classic what they used to do in 9/11 thing, deleted all the comments, deleted all the Substack, and also she deleted all the Twitter. So you can't go back and cross-reference the things she said. And this is what they do. So on Facebook, it used to be annoying because you'd argue with someone and give a good account of yourself and your views, and they would delete the comment, and then everything would disappear because you were in replying to them, so it would take your comments with them. Substack doesn't do that. My comments are still there, but Abby deleted all her comments in her Substack. So these things do not look good. Do not look good to me.
Francis, thank you. depressing, but kind of interesting, I hope. Where can people find you? I mean, not your address, obviously, because that would be dangerous, but.
I'm at francisoneill.substack.com and francisoneill.net. For my paintings.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. It's been great talking to you. And everyone else, I love those of you who support me. Those of you who enjoy my stuff, thank you. And those who make the extra effort to become paid subscribers. You can go to my website now, which is jamesdellingpole.co.uk. And please go there and you can sign up, support my sponsors, and buy me coffee if you don't want to. Actually, no, there's no reason why you shouldn't sign up to my website. It's good. Thank you again, Francis O'Neill.
I feel bad now. We should talk about something else next time.
We can next time. We'll talk about My Little Pony and Teletubbies and...
Oh, no.
What? Come on. My Little Pony and Teletubbies. I mean, they're going to be mind control, aren't they? Par excellence.
I don't know. Probably.
In excelsis.
Probably.
Of course they are.
Apparently everything is, but from what I'm, you know, there's a lot of it around anyway.
I've heard this too.
Yeah.
Thank you, Francis.
Thank you.
And Oh, you're only 65% uploaded, so don't turn off your machine yet.
I won't.
Upload. Okay, I'm going to go now because I've got to have lunch.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay. A lot of you have very kindly been asking, what's the best way we can support you? So thank you for caring and thank you for wanting to support me. There is now a new, better way of supporting me. Some of you subscribe via Substack. Some of you are on Patreon. Some of you are even on Subscribestar. And those all work in their way. The problem is, I find, I mean, take Substack as an example. Substack has been a great community for like-minded folk, but it is heavily controlled by the enemy. They deboost people like me. They want normie voices. They don't want really alternative people being given any prominence. Plus, of course, they get a cut of your generous donations. So here's an idea. If you want to, you can now subscribe direct on my website at jamesdellingpole.co.uk. The website's been running for quite a while, but thanks to my assistant Andrew, it's now got new features where you can subscribe directly to me. You get access to all my old archive material. You get my podcasts as they come out, and you can comment on the podcast and you can communicate with me probably more directly than you can elsewhere. I think it's probably the best way forward. Also, it obviates the risk of my being suddenly randomly closed down by some of these other websites. I mean, they're not our friends. So if you want to support me direct, go to jamesdellingpole.co.uk and sign up there. Thank you, my sharklings. I love you all, but I love... You know, I'm not supposed to have favourites, but I do kind of extra love those of you who make the effort to support me, because without your support, I wouldn't be able to do what I do. So, thank you.
Support Ridiculously Honest, No Holds Barred, Independent Truth Seeking at jamesdellingpole.co.uk.